Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome everybody to this show on Crime and Science Radio. It's called Working Stiff, an interview with forensic pathologist Judy Melnick and her co-author husband T.J. Mitchell. Dr. Melnick has trained in a lot of areas. In her medicine and pathology training, she's attended Harvard University, UCLA, and worked in the office of the chief medical examiner in New York. TJ has an English degree from Harvard and spent time in the film industry before opting out of all that to become a full-time stay-home dad for their three children. And the two of them co-authored Dr. Melnick's book about her career and the development of a forensic pathologist in her memoir titled Working Stiff. And currently, they're collaborating on the first book called First Cut, which will be the inaugural novel in their forensic detective fiction series, which sounds fascinating. So, Judy and TJ, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with Judy, what led you into medicine and then from there into the arena of forensic pathology?
My father was a doctor. In fact, he was a psychiatrist, so I grew up with medicine in the house. Textbooks, anatomy books, all sorts of different information that was available, articles that he would bring home, and I was always fascinated by it and asked him about it. I bonded with him over science. I remember specifically going out to dinner with him once and him explaining the way nerves work with the chemicals over the synapses on a napkin at Church's Fried Chicken. So this is how we connected together. And so that's what drew me to medicine. Specifically, forensic pathology was something I discovered later in my career. I went to medical school and initially was drawn to surgery because it was so practical and hands-on. The problem was that surgery residency is incredibly demanding, and in the second chapter of Working Stiff, TJ and I write about the crazy schedules that I had to have in order to just do my basic training. I quit after about 6 months and switched to pathology. I had some experience with pathology as a medical student, but didn't have the passion for it that I had for surgery until I found forensics. Forensics had the same excitement and practical applications that surgery did for me.
Well, after you finished your training and all that, I kind of did the same thing because I knew I was going to deal with hearts, but cardiovascular surgery lost all fascination for me when I saw how boring it was and time-consuming. And the hours that those poor schmucks put in was unbelievable. So I went to the medical side, and I understand that completely. Since you finished all your training, you then were with the medical examiner's office in New York. What was that all about? And then how did you end up developing your company that you have now? What was the process there?
So the training process for pathologist is after you finish medical school, you have to do a residency in hospital pathology. So I first trained in anatomic and clinical pathology. The way I explain that is anytime you go to the hospital and somebody says, we got to run some tests, as long as they're not shooting x-rays at you, it's pathology. So
right.
Either they're drawing blood or they're taking specimens or urine or any test that goes to a laboratory, that's going to be seen and reviewed by a pathologist. So that was how I was initially trained. In hospital pathology, you also learn how to do autopsies, but those autopsies are in patients who have been hospitalized. So they come to you with a medical history. There's a big chart, there's information, and the autopsy is usually being done because the family or the doctors want to know a little bit more about how they died or whether their treatment, their therapy worked. It's not really about figuring out the cause of death. In most of those cases, we know why they died because they were hospitalized and they were ill for so long, but we're trying to understand the mechanisms or the disease better. Forensics is different. For forensic pathology, you have to do fellowship training at a coroner medical examiner's office, and I chose to go to New York because it was the most interesting place to study forensic pathology for my colleagues' recommendations.
Yeah, basically everybody, Judy went to UCLA Medical School and UCLA for residency in pathology, and when she started asking around, everybody said, well, LA is not a very exciting place to go train at the coroner's department because there's a lot of car crashes, a lot of drug overdoses. And one of her colleagues said, now, you should go to New York. In New York, there's all kinds of variety in the way people die, and it's really true.
Yeah,
they're more skilled.
It is, and it's a lot less car-oriented culture, so you get to see a lot more interesting ways of traumatic injury. But that said, I did the fellowship training in New York from 2001 to 2003. So as you know, the medical cycle starts in July, so I started July 1st, 2001. And basically I had only about 2 months of training before September 11th happened. I started writing the notes for Working Stiff, the notes that eventually I handed off to TJ and we wrote together into the memoir. Those were written with the expectation or with the desire to chronicle the training process. But once I started writing a journal every day, as you know, as a writer, it becomes a habit and it becomes in some ways a therapy of sorts. So it was important to me, became more and more important as the years went on to help me figure out what I was going through and to process what I was learning.
Cool.
So just to talk a little bit, you mentioned autopsies. Television dramas give the public this impression that every case gets autopsied. How far is that from reality? And maybe you could also talk, as somebody has a responsibility to perform them, what's the deciding factors? What are the deciding factors determining whether there'll be an autopsy or not?
According to state law, any case that is sudden, unexpected, or violent, basically an unexpected death, needs to be reported to the coroner or the medical examiner. The coroner or medical examiner has a mandate to investigate the cases that fall under state law, but they don't have to autopsy every single one. So the decision of whether or not to do an autopsy is often dependent on the individual predilection or priorities of that office, things like staffing, things like how many other cases came in, and also funding can influence whether or not a full autopsy is done or even just what we call an external examination, or in some offices they call it an inspection. So it's highly case-specific and highly jurisdiction-specific. In general, if a case is violent or suspicious, it's more likely going to get an autopsy than not. Even traumatic deaths where the death is violent but it's not considered to be part of foul play, for instance, a motor vehicle fatality, if there's enough injury on the outside of the body to determine, yep, they died from getting hit by a car, they may not have a full autopsy. It really depends on the jurisdiction.
So now you were saying we kind of got off maybe a little bit with your work history because you did your fellowship at the New York ME's office. Did you remain in big city? Did you remain in New York? Did you stay with the big city ME's office, or what happened after that? And maybe you could just sort of give us an idea of, in the course of your work, how many autopsies you've performed over these years.
So to date, I've performed close to 3,000 autopsies. I do about 200 a year, so that's a ballpark. Mm-hmm. Some years it'll be less, some years it'll be more, but I try to aim to about 200 a year. And what happened after New York was after I trained in my fellowship in New York, because I had a license to practice medicine in California since I had trained at UCLA, TJ and I, and at that point our two children, because we only had Danny and Leia at the time, we relocated to Santa Clara County. I worked at the Santa Clara County Medical Examiner Coroner's Office. They have this very long name, hybrid name. And I was there for only 1 year. Then I was at the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office for approximately 9 years. And currently I work at the Alameda County Sheriff Coroner's Office. So that includes the cities of Oakland and Berkeley.
And Santa Clara County is in San Jose, California, which is the middle of Silicon Valley. So that's where we ended up going after New York. We moved there for exactly 1 year before coming to San Francisco.
So to answer your question, most of the offices I've worked at have been urban offices. That said, I also do consulting work. So I do review cases from all over the country and even internationally. So they involve even rural cases in other jurisdictions. But I do that as a medical legal consultant, What happens is either families have concerns about an autopsy that was performed elsewhere outside of my jurisdiction, or attorneys in legal cases, whether they're criminal or civil, want to have a pathologist to review the findings and see if I agree or disagree or can find other interesting things for them to explore in their legal cases based on the autopsy that was performed elsewhere.
So, okay, so families can ask you, or attorneys may, and then for your government agency work, is that where most of your cases come from, though, or who and whom there ask you to become involved?
So most of my cases where I perform autopsies are done for the Alameda County Sheriff Coroner. I'm a government contractor, and I get called in to do autopsies. Typically, I work on Wednesday, Thursday, and Fridays in the morning. But what I do is I can call in and find out whether they have cases. If they don't have any cases, or if they only have one or two, sometimes I'll leave it for my colleagues. So we just play text message tag in the morning to decide who's going to get the cases, and then I go in and I do them. But I'm not there all the time. The rest of the time I'm at my office in San Francisco fielding calls, talking to attorneys, doing paperwork, things like that.
But Judy's office in San Francisco is not associated with the medical examiner's office. It's just our own business office.
That's where you do independent consulting work for other cases outside the jurisdictional job that you have.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, one of the obviously the most important questions that a coroner or medical examiner in the forensic arena must answer is the cause and manner of time and death and time of death, because they all obviously impact a criminal case dramatically. In fact, they often decide whether there is a criminal case or not. So in your experience, let's kind of look at each of these in individually. What's the most common causes of death that you see in your practice?
Typically, I will see natural deaths and accidents. So both natural and accidents are a manner of death. Among the natural deaths, I will see heart attacks, heart disease, congestive heart failure. That's the number one killer of most Americans, is heart disease, usually coupled with obesity, with being overweight. With regards to the accidental manners, I would pretty much estimate that the overwhelming majority are overdoses, either from prescription drug abuse or misuse, or from injection street drug use.
And traumatic accidents are, it seems to me, highly place-dependent. So in New York City, she didn't see very many motor vehicle accidents. She did see pedestrian versus train. Most of the time, that was suicide. But in other places, you would see a lot of motor vehicle accidents. That's one area that does depend on place more than other manners of death do.
So here in California, I tend to see more motor vehicles because of freeways.
Sure.
And also just people backing out of their driveways and not looking.
And nobody walks in L.A., so there is that in the Bay Area either. But when it's not obvious.
They're less likely to die if they're stuck in traffic. So it
really
has to do with the speed.
Well, when the cause of death isn't, you know, a train or a gunshot wound, and it's not obvious, what are the things that you look for to determine the unusual causes of death? You've got a corpse. There's no answer that jumps in your face. What process do you go through to start determining what really led to the demise?
We don't start with a corpse, for one thing. We start with the scene investigation. So in every office, whether it's a coroner or a medical examiner's office, there are police agencies or coroner's investigators that go out to the scene and document the findings, because their eyes and ears are what we rely upon when we are interpreting whatever we see on the body. We can't look at the body in a vacuum. So they will come back and write reports that summarize things about when the person was last seen alive, who found them, what the condition of the body was when it was found, and they'll actually take photographs at the scene to help give us a context for the position of the body or the condition of the body. Then, after we review all that material in the morgue or in the morning meeting before we get into the morgue, the next step is to look at the body, and I start off by looking at the outside of the body for signs of disease or injury. So I start off basically head to So I have a body diagram and a checklist, and I look at the eyes. What color are they? What are the whites of the eyes? Are they white or are they yellow? Are there any piercings of the ears, of the nose? Are there any tattoos or identifying marks? And I just work my way down the body documenting everything, first on the external examination, and then I start the internal examination. Each organ is taken out. It's weighed. There are measurements taken. If there's anything unusual, if I see a tumor, I'll measure that. And I will also collect body fluids during that time. So but blood will be collected in order to assess and send to toxicology and figure out if there's any drugs or alcohol in their system. And other fluids are also collected. We collect the clear fluid behind the eye, the vitreous. We collect urine if the bladder is full, and other specimens like bile or brain. All of that is saved regardless of the case. So even if it's an obvious motor vehicle accident or an obvious gunshot wound, a lot of what we do is just protocol, and we do it in order to make sure that everything's preserved so that if there are any questions that come up afterwards, we can address them. So if I do a full autopsy and I document all the external signs of injury, the internal signs of injury, and also the signs of disease, I can usually in 90% of the cases figure out the cause of death. In order to figure out the manner of death, whether it's an accident, a suicide, a homicide, or natural, I need to be able to have something about the circumstances. I need to know about the police investigation or the scene findings from our investigators.
So that gives us sort of an idea of what you do with those major categories. And does that pretty much make up your day? Is your day begin with, you mentioned a morning meeting. Sort of what is a typical day for you? We know, you know, that part of it is doing the things you just described, but what would an average day for someone who's working in forensic pathology be like in an office like one you're working in?
Well, you know, when we started writing Working Stiff, I had the exact same question for Judy. Because before we could begin to explore the cases that she did in New York, first we had to explain to the reader, what is an autopsy? And I found myself asking that question, what exactly is an autopsy? Because I'd never asked her, what do you do every day? So we started with that. What time do you go in? What do you wear? Who's in the room with you? What tools do you use? And exactly what Judy just described, the external exam in the autopsy, she told me about, and then the internal exam. How do you start it, and what do you do? What's every step?
So we start off in the morning with that morning meeting. That's at around 8 o'clock in the morning. I usually get in the morgue at 9. I'm usually done doing my autopsies by around noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Then I eat lunch, and I know that most people are –
people are always amused when she says, I eat lunch, but she has to eat lunch, you know.
Right, so. And it's physical labor. It's hard. You're standing there. You're using your arms and your legs, and after several hours, you're hungry. So I go and I eat lunch, and then usually in the afternoon, after lunch, I will dictate my report. So based on the notes that I took in the autopsy, I will log into my phone and dictate what my findings are for each case, and then I'll close out other cases. So every day, I'll typically get between 1 to 3 autopsies a day, and I can finish a typical autopsy in about 45 minutes from the dissecting part, but if you include the dictation and the other paperwork, it's maybe another, you know, half an hour on top of that. And so I can do 3 autopsies between around 9 and 12, and then I can dictate after lunch, and then I'll do paperwork and close out my old cases. So I might get in 2 cases in the morning, and then I usually try to get out 2 cases in the afternoon by finishing them. And to finish a case, that means I will get the report from toxicology that tells me if there's any drugs or alcohol in their system. I'll review my dictation to make sure it's accurate and there are no typos. Typically, they're not. I have excellent transcriptionists in Alameda County. And then after that, I also look at the medical records that I've requested and look at microscopic slides. So if there's any tissue from the autopsy that I wanted to look at under a microscope, those come back as glass slides. And I will write an additional report on the microscopic findings. So closing out a case can take anywhere from a few minutes, if it's just toxicology, to several hours, especially if there are special stains or additional testing that I would want to do. And there are some cases that take many months, not because we spend all month long on it, but because we send out for additional testing, and then we have to wait until it comes back. And then we have to find the time to look at the results when they come back. So they could span many months until I can finish a complicated case, even though the actual operating time on that case is only maybe 2 or 3 hours.
Well, you give me a chance to tackle a myth there. What I have heard from other forensic pathologists is a myth. When you take that lunch break, are you bending over a corpse while you're eating a sandwich, or are you going to a lunchroom?
Absolutely not. It is a violation of office safety and health procedures. So the OSHA, the organization that oversees workplace, it would shut us down in a heartbeat if they knew that we were eating in the morgue. And it's unsanitary, and I don't want to put myself at risk of catching any infectious diseases because I'm doing something that's improper in our morgue. So a morgue is a laboratory. I know that on old TV shows they've got Quincy eating cookies over the body. That does not happen. Typically, I will bring in food, and we have a little lunchroom, and I can heat it up in the microwave there.
Although, of course, while Judy worked in San Francisco is perhaps the greatest eating city in the world, so she generally went out to eat for lunch.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I assume you also don't have just everybody in the world able to walk in without being suited up or anything.
We're suited up. We're suited up very, we're very much covered up. And actually, I should mention, I have a blog post. So I do have a blog. It's at my website, pathologyexpert.com, and you could look for the blog under writing. I do have an entry at the blog called 7 CSI Fails that specifically addresses some of the problems that television forensics shows have in portraying forensic pathologists and our practice accurately. And one of those things that they don't portray is they keep on forgetting about personal protective equipment. We have booties. We have a full Tyvek suit. We have a plastic apron that covers also our arms and has little thumb holes. We have gloves underneath. There's these mesh gloves that are made out of, sometimes they're made out of Tyvek or Gore-Tex. No, not Gore-Tex. What's it called? The stuff that's
just like the typical latex kind of.
No, so the bottom layer is nitrile. Then I have another layer that looks like cloth, but it's like the material that's in bulletproof vests. It's cut resistant. Mm. And then on top of that, I'll have a heavy duty glove that's similar to the kind of gloves that you use when you clean your kitchen or your bathroom with heavy duty chemicals. It's really thick, rubbery material.
It's like Kevlar.
So it doesn't. Kevlar, thank you, that's the word I was looking for, Kevlar in the middle. So it's a sandwich of three different gloves, and the reason we're doing this is because we're dealing with sharp implements. I'm dealing with scalpels. I can inadvertently cut myself, so I want to be protected from HIV and hepatitis C and all other types of bloodborne pathogens.
Now, that said, police officers do come into the morgue, and other civilians are allowed to come into the morgue with the permission of the doctor, and sometimes the family, right?
Yeah, so we've had in the past, we've had even news crews who have come to report on what we were doing to educate the public. And again, that has to be with the permission of the coroner, and they do have to put on face masks to protect themselves. As long as they're at a distance, we don't require them to completely gown up. But anybody who's getting close to the body and could be at risk of getting blood splashed on them should have gear on.
And students, too, of course.
Yeah, we have students as well as residents, other young doctors who are in training.
Well, a little earlier, you mentioned some of the manners of death, so maybe we could talk a little bit more about what each of those means. I think there's also confusion about, specifically, these are terms we hear tossed around a lot, but what each of those is really a very technical meaning for them in your field. So could you go over those again, please?
So the way I like to think about it is that the cause of death is the how question. How did the person die, and what was the disease or injury? So is it from cancer? Is it from heart disease? Is it from cocaine? That's going to be the cause. The manner is a classification of the cause. So, for instance, if someone has a heart attack, that heart attack could be from too much cocaine, in which case it would be an accident. That heart attack could be from too much cholesterol in their blood vessels, in which case it would be natural. Or if they had a heart attack after they were shot in the leg and they started to bleed out, that would be a consequence of a gunshot wound, and that could be either suicide or homicide.
So the manner of death answers a what question, as in what kind of death is this?
Right.
And so when we think about that, we can classify it into five different categories. Natural is due to disease or injury. Accident is due to some sort of unforeseeable act. The most common we see is motor vehicle fatalities. Suicide is due to a self-destructive act at one's own hand. Homicide, by definition, is death at the hand of another. And that's one that a lot of people confuse with murder or manslaughter, but they're not the same thing. So homicide can be if someone, for example, if someone breaks into your house and you shoot them in self-defense, we would still call it homicide. But you might not get charged with either murder or manslaughter because you were justified in shooting them based on your state laws. In other circumstances, when the police are restraining someone and the person dies, the medical examiner could call it a homicide, but there may never be charges filed if the police were acting within the purview of their jobs and were considered to be acting appropriately. So that's the difference between homicide versus murder. And then the final option is what we call undetermined. That's the I don't know answer. But undetermined can also mean that we just don't have enough evidence. We have a death that's a gunshot wound, could be interpreted as a homicide, could potentially be a suicide, could even be an accident, but we just don't have enough information, either because there was an insufficient police investigation or because the body is too decomposed or the scene has been compromised in some way. There could be lots of different reasons why information can point us in multiple different directions.
Well, in that undetermined category, you describe it in Working Stiff as inconclusive and supremely frustrating, which absolutely is true. And you said your mentor, Dr. Charles Hirsch, taught you that the cause and manner of death are written on paper and they're not carved in stone, and they can change with time. How does that come about? What would make you have something that was undetermined and then later find a category that it fit into, or that it looked like this, but as you dug deeper, it turned into another manner of death. Can you tell us about how that works and what you've seen?
Sure. An example I can give where we changed the death certificate, and this isn't from undetermined, this is from suicide to accident, is a case where there's a man who had a medical condition where his potassium was very low. It was a natural condition, and it was treated by him taking a lot of potassium. So he took so much potassium that he actually became intoxicated on potassium, and he caused himself an arrhythmia, an irregular rhythm of the heart that killed him. And at the scene, he was there with the empty bottles of potassium. Now, nobody takes potassium to get high. You don't get any physical sensation from potassium to make yourself feel better. So when we to make yourself, you know, feel in a good way, the way you would with certain drugs or intoxicants. So based on the scene, we certified the case as a suicide. I certified the case as a suicide. Well, next I got a call from the family saying he's not suicidal. He didn't leave a note, and I tried to explain there's no way somebody would take all this stuff and it be an accident. But it turns out that his sister went with him to the doctor at his last doctor's visit, and the doctor basically told him that there's no harm in taking as much as he wants, and if he doesn't feel good, he should just keep taking it. So based on that, I changed it from suicide to an accident, given that additional information that I didn't have before. So sometimes that additional information is communication from the family. Sometimes it's information from the medical records. Sometimes it's witnesses who didn't speak up initially or weren't interviewed or nobody told them about the death, and then they call and find out later. So all of that could potentially change a case from a suicide to an accident or from an accident to undetermined.
Yeah.
So since we're working with mystery writers among our listeners, I'm going to give you an example that I have a feeling Doug may have had somebody email him one of these kinds of questions, but we know we actually see them in the news as well. where there are cases where someone is assaulted, they're in a coma from a brain injury for an extended period of time, and then die from a medical condition, like they'll have a pneumonia or a kidney infection. So would that be called a natural death or homicide?
It's a really good question, and these cases can be very difficult because of the delay between when the injury occurred and the final death. So it's really important in a case like that, when I do an autopsy, to document not only the physical findings at the time of autopsy, but to review those medical records, that unbroken chain of events starting from the injury to the death. So even James Brady, for instance, who was shot when the attempted assassination on Ronald Reagan's life occurred, when he died many years later, because there was an unbroken chain of events of continued health decline from the injury to the death, that death was classified as a homicide, even though technically his final weeks or days probably had to do more with complications of infection. So if you're, the examples that you gave, those of a pneumonia or a kidney infection, if they are something that occurs as a result of the person's debility, for instance, they are paralyzed in a coma and therefore they're more prone to pneumonia, they're more prone to urinary tract infections, then I would have no problem classifying the death as a homicide, even if it was many years later. The way the cause of death would be written is infectious complications of remote gunshot wound to head, if that's where the injury was. And then it would be classified a homicide. However, if the patient had pre-existing heart disease, for example, high blood pressure, hypertension, and the final moments of death were not because of an infection, they were because of the high blood pressure, the burst blood vessel in the brain, a stroke, or a cardiac event, that may be totally unrelated to the gunshot wound. That might have happened anyway if they had never gotten the gunshot wound. So we have to really look at the natural disease and see if it is increased or made worse by the traumatic injury. If they're totally unrelated, then you can't call that case a homicide. In fact, I've had cases of patients who have been paralyzed from gunshot wounds but continued to smoke crack cocaine, and then they died of crack overdoses. So they were paralyzed from the waist down, but they still had their arms and could continue to abuse drugs. And so when their death occurred, everybody suspected it was a remote injury from the gunshot wound, but it wasn't. It was just an overdose.
We have a great example in – it's actually on the Science Friday website. The NPR show Science Friday has an excerpt from the cutting room floor of Working Stiff. This is a story that was originally in Working Stiff. We had to remove it when we were cutting the book down just for concision. And it's a story, I call it the pink eye of death. It's about a guy who got shot in the face when he was a teenager and lived for another 12 or 13 years with the bullet lodged behind his eye because the surgeons didn't think that taking the bullet out would be a safe thing to do. He ended up getting a bacterial infection of the brain and dying of that, which is a really terrible way to die. The question that Judy had to figure out is whether that bacterial infection had traveled up from the outside from where the bullet is and crossed the blood-brain barrier that way, or whether it had come from inside his body and what she was seeing on the outside had originated in the body. That would determine whether this is a homicide or a natural death. And I won't tell you how the story ends. You'll have to go to Science Friday.
The other thing that we mentioned earlier that you have to determine, of course, is the time of death. And I know that there's several techniques that are employed in various cases, sometimes some of them, sometimes all of them. And I also know that none of them are all that accurate. And I also know the medical examiner can't say he died at 10:15 last night. But writers seem to think so, and the public seems to think so. So in your experience, obviously, this is a critical determination because alibis and witness statements and everything fall by the wayside if the timeline is screwed up. What methods do you find the most useful in general, body temperature, rigor mortis, all that stuff? And have you been fooled? Are there cases you've run across where you had to scratch your head and say, wow, I'm just not sure here. I got conflicting data.
I have to rely on not just one methodology, but I find that the more methodologies I rely on, the more accurate things are. And you have to listen to your investigators about the scene and circumstances as well. You can't just interpret it, again, like I said, in a vacuum. So body temperature is very helpful. The body will lose about 1.5 to 2 degrees an hour in Fahrenheit. So you can measure the body temperature, but you also have to measure and consider the ambient temperature. And children who are smaller but have larger surface area relative to their size are going to lose body temperature faster than an adult would. You can have an obese individual who's heavily clothed and they will retain their temperature for longer than a skinny individual who's naked in a cold environment. So you have to accommodate for stuff like that. The same thing with regards to rigidity, lividity. We consider all of that. So the blood pooling after death, that is called livor mortis or livor mortis. And then the rigidity is the stiffening up of the muscles after death. Usually it peaks in about 12 to 24 hours, and then it'll start to relax. So in about 2 days after the person dies, they're going to be loose and loosey-goosey again. But the lividity at that point, after the rigidity has passed, the lividity will be fixed, which means that if I press against the surface of the body where the blood has pooled, it is no longer going to get blanching. It's not going to get white again. It'll stay red because the fluid has come, the blood has come out of the blood vessels and is now in the soft tissue. So we'll rely on all of those things, lividity, rigidity, body temperature. I like to use all three. There are other more important things, though, which is when was the person last seen alive and when were they found dead? And that really gives us kind of our intervals that we're working with. That said, you can get fooled, like you said. So I did have a case once where I got a call from our investigator because this guy was dead sitting on the sofa in the middle of August in San Francisco, and he was, you know, dead on the sofa, and his roommate had seen him alive the night before. But when our investigators got there in the morning, when he was found unresponsive, he was already starting to decompose. And the roommate was a little shifty. They were both drug users, so they really suspected that the roommate was lying to them, because how could he decompose within so few hours if he was alive the night before?
And we should explain that August in San Francisco is cold. I know it's hard to imagine, but the infamous fog that comes in, it comes in the summertime, and August can be in the mid-60s and clammy.
So the investigator called me and wanted me to come out to the scene, and I happened to pay attention to the fact that it was freezing cold the night before because I had the heat on in my apartment. So I asked him, just out of curiosity, where exactly is the sofa? He goes, well, it's in the middle of the room. I said, well, where is the heater for the house? Well, it turns out the heating register was right next to the sofa. And I asked him, can you ask the roommate if the heat was on last night? And it turns out that the heat was on full blast the night before, and the guy was basically sitting in front of the heater all night long. But by the time morning came, they had turned it off because they didn't need it this much. So that really explained the condition of the body relative to the time interval that was involved.
Something that Judy had to explain to me when we were doing the chapter on decomps in Working Stiff was that each case is unique and each decomp informs her about the circumstances that lead to decomposition, how big the person is, what the temperature is, the presence or absence of animals for animal depredation. There's all kinds of factors that go in. And it's really through experience that a medical examiner can put a ballpark on a distant time of death. But it's nowhere near what you expect if you watch television.
And what we can testify to in court sometimes, too. I mean, we can give a ballpark. We could say, you know, the body is consistent with a death occurring around the time of the stated incident, or the body is not consistent with that. But we can't do it with any degree of scientific certainty where we can give, you know, errors, standard errors, or, point to the medical literature with the same degree of certainty, for example, that DNA analysis has.
Right. It's a best guess, usually, yes.
It's an educated guess, and it's built on experience.
Sure, exactly. Well, you know, we've kind of danced around this. We've talked about Working Stiff, so I want you to tell us a little bit about that, what the book's about, how you organized it, and why the heck did you decide to write it in the first place?
Well, Judy mentioned that she kept a diary for the entire 2 years that she did her fellowship in forensic pathology. She did religiously keep that diary every day. And then at the end of the 2 years, she handed it off to me and said, "You're a writer, so I'll write." And I said, "Okay, this will be great." And I also had decided, we had decided together, that I was going to be a full-time stay-at-home dad. Our son at the time was about 6 months old, you know, cute little baby boy. I figure I'll just stick him in the corner and I can write all day. This will be great. And, yeah, as any parent will tell you, that did not work out so well.
Now, when you watch the baby, you got to watch the baby.
Yes, right. And it was really about 10 years before I was able to dedicate myself full-time to writing Working Stiff. There was another factor at work, too, which is that part of Judy's experience was the Twin Towers attack on September 11th. She's one of the 30 doctors who identified the remains of the victims of the September 11th attack. And every time we tried to tackle that material, we really couldn't handle it. It took the passage of time before we were able to face it ourselves. And especially the 10-year anniversary really triggered for us the feeling that it was no longer a matter of personal history, but history, and that it should be told, especially for our children's generation. For them, September 11th is like the JFK assassination was for my generation, or like Pearl Harbor was for the generation before that. It's an event that is a milestone, a before and after event, and we wanted to make sure that our children and their peers understood what that meant, since they were babies when it happened. So Judy had taken all of these stories, and she rearranged them into the manners of death, and then handed it off to me, and together we decided which ones are the best representations and the most interesting stories, and then we started working on it together.
We discovered, though, pretty quickly that we couldn't work in the same room together because then we'd get interrupted by our now three children. So at that point, we were primarily doing it by email. TJ would work on the chapter, email it to me during my lunch break or after I finished at work. I would take an hour and review it. Primarily, we picked the stories that had the most teaching potential, the ones that I learned the most from, either a forensic lesson, something interesting forensically, or an emotional lesson, a lesson about life, about how to deal with grieving relatives.
Right, because the arc of the story, and of course every good story has to have an arc, right? The challenge when you're writing a memoir is whose life has an arc, right? Well, the arc of Working Stiff is that Judy is learning how to do forensic autopsies. She doesn't know how when she starts out. She is a doctor, but doctors, as you know, don't learn how to investigate death. They do that on the job.
Right.
So the reader gets to learn how to do death investigation on the job along with Judy while she's learning.
And that's one of the reasons 9/11 is towards the end of the book, because not only when you're training can you not really understand a mass disaster response without knowing how to do your day-to-day job, but also I wanted to take the reader through what the day-to-day is like for natural deaths, accidents, suicides, before they could even wrap their head around the complexity of a mass disaster response.
You know, I think one of the things we should probably touch upon, a lot of people think of the work as being gruesome or, you know, they might wonder, especially for you, TJ, since you're not medically trained yourself, did anything make you squeamish?
Oh, yes, a lot made me squeamish. Before we started writing the book, a lot of what Judy did made me squeamish. She would come home and, you know, any married couple would just say, "So, dear, what did you do today?" And she didn't have a good filter of what a normal person would find horrifying and what a normal person would find fascinating. So it took a while for me to educate her, I think, in that arena. Also, a lot of the things that I wanted to know, she couldn't tell me. So I would say, a couple of weeks after she did a terrible murder, I'd say, "Hey, so what happened with that murder case? Where'd it go?" And she said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, don't you go and find out?" She said, "No, I have plenty of other work to do. I don't go skulking around the DA's office to ask about my old cases. I've got new cases." But some of the things that she would describe to me were pretty horrible, but I think that I got more used to them, and she learned what my limits were.
Yeah, the other thing he always wants to know about is where did it happen? And I never really pay attention to where in the city it happened. I think on some level TJ was thinking, well, maybe if I avoid that intersection, I will be safe. It was just
It was fascinating to me when we were writing the book that, again, we've got a chapter on decomps, which I was dreading writing. I thought writing a chapter about decomposing bodies is going to be a horrible chore, and it's going to be this soul-sucking hole in the middle of the book no one's going to want to read. And, in fact, I think it is the most fascinating chapter in the book, and I was amazed at how much I learned about the human body and its return to the soil cycle by writing this chapter. And that was a real shock to me because I'm not a doctor, and I am as squeamish as any other civilian, but I actually really enjoyed writing about decomposing bodies.
I also think one of the other misconceptions about the work is that it's only for the dead, which, at least in my view, it's for the living, primarily. I mean, yes, justice and an indemnity for the dead, but a lot of that also comes back to relate to the living and the families and the community. But at the same time, there's a real shortage of people entering the profession. Could you talk to us about why we need more people in forensic pathology?
It's a real problem. We do not have enough forensic pathologists. I know that if you watch television, you get the impression there's one on every corner. But really, we have a severe shortage of pathologists entering the field. And there are multiple different reasons. One of them is because requirements for accreditation at certain medical schools and residency programs don't require as many autopsies as they used to. And in the past, and in some areas, they don't require a forensic rotation. Also, there's no requirement that medical students be even exposed to a forensic rotation. So they don't even know or think about it as an option outside of what they see on television. On top of that, there's the financial remuneration problem, because you can finish training as a hospital pathologist and make approximately $100,000 more per year if doing hospital pathology than if you take an extra year of training to become a forensic pathologist, and now you're going to be working at a government agency which is underfunded and understaffed, and you now have a pay cut of about $100,000 that will last basically through the rest of your career. So you have to really have a passion for it. I do think that the government entities that are having problems filling spots are going to have to come up with some sort of carrot, some sort of encouragement, like allowing medical students to have their debt forgiven for going into this field, and also requiring the training to be done at an earlier level, probably in medical school, to draw more people into the field.
And there is a lot of social work in the field, too, that you don't realize until you learn that as on-the-job training. Judy is very good at explaining disease processes and traumatic injury to lay people, because she has to do that every day for the families of the deceased, and she also has to do it in court to a jury. So she doesn't use MedSpeak as much as most doctors do, unless she's talking to other doctors, and then it's all gibberish. But she's very good at talking to ordinary people about death.
And that's the most rewarding part of the job, is the fact that you, every day you go into work, you have no idea who you're going to serve. It could be a rich person, it could be a poor person. It's just any random human being who happened to have the bad luck of dying in your jurisdiction over the past 24 hours. And so then, in many cases, you develop relationships with those families while you're working on the case, while you're getting information, and then subsequently, if there's any lawsuit or criminal legal aspect, you will have contact sometimes with the families for many years to come.
Hmm.
Well, do you discuss your job with your kids?
I do, in so much as that I have a lot of street cred when they're doing something dangerous, and I say, I know somebody who died that way. They usually stop whatever it is right away. I mean, I can get them to listen to me, where most parents probably don't. So in that way, I will. And I do, you know, we do discuss over the dining room table in general, oh, what did you do today? I had an overdose and a motor vehicle accident. And then at some point, Leia will usually say, okay, can we talk about something else?
Yeah, and also, people don't realize that most of what Judy investigates, as we say in the first chapter of the book, are things that are predictably hazardous. And to explain that to the kids is very simple. Judy sees a lot of drug deaths and gunshot wounds, And it's easy to explain to the kids, yeah, well, somebody got shot and that's why he died.
Kids can grasp that,
yeah.
I mean, I don't shy away from talking to the kids about death. In fact, I think death is a really important part of life that we don't talk enough about. There's actually a movement now about, it's called the Death Positive Movement. It's advocated by an organization called Death Salon. I actually spoke at a death salon last year at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and they do them throughout the country where educators, morticians, artists, anybody who is interested in talking about death or discussing grieving in a positive way, they get together and they have lectures, and it's an intellectual salon. I really encourage people to look it up and educate themselves about it, because even though the idea sounds morbid, it's actually just the opposite. The more you spend thinking about death, talking about death, the more it becomes a normal part of life, and it becomes a lot less scary, and you're a lot more prepared for it when it does happen to you or a loved one.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think we pay a price for avoiding it, and a higher price than people would imagine, how much it affects their lives. And certainly in public policy, it's huge, I think. But we won't get into that because we don't have another hour show, right?
I wish we did. In fact, we're getting close to the end here, and I don't want to go off the air without discussing the future. And you guys are working now on First Cut, which you said was a forensic detective fiction. Tell us about that. What's the concept? What's your hero about, and kind of what the stories that you're working on? You don't have to give away the ending, but what is this, and where is it going? How do you envision it?
So while I was working at the San Francisco Medical Examiner's office, I was struck by all of the stories that I continue to discover on a daily basis, but I thought it would be much more fun instead of just recreating another working stiff where I talk about case studies, I thought of some of my more interesting cases, specifically homicides, and what would happen if they were related or a detective forensic pathologist could link them together. And some of the inspiration from it came from my own experiences, but I definitely wanted a protagonist who was younger and less experienced than I am now, because part of the interest for me in working stiff was about the learning process, the learning curve of the training program. And so the detective literature that's out there, the typical Patricia Cornwell and Kathy Reichs that are out there, tend to focus on the forensic investigator who is an expert in her field. And I'm much more interested in the young, slightly naive investigator who's just starting off her practice. And I've always been drawn to noir. So similar to working stiff, I started putting together some chapters. I got about 11 chapters in, and then I handed it off to TJ and said, here, can you do something with this? So at this point.
Yeah, and our heroine, her name is Jessie Teska. She is essentially Judy, but 10 years younger and unencumbered by me or the children and with a deeper psychic wound. It's set here in San Francisco, which is a city that we really love. It's set in contemporary San Francisco, and you can't go far wrong writing a mystery in San Francisco.
Especially noir.
Yes.
Exactly.
And we're really enjoying it. Well, and also the source of comic relief is that Jessie trained and was working in Los Angeles and really loves Los Angeles and then had to move to San Francisco, but all the things that we love about San Francisco, she hates. So she doesn't drink wine. She likes to drive her car. She could care less about bicycling or walking. She's not going to take the bus. She doesn't care much about fancy food.
And she loves sunshine.
She loves sunshine and hot weather. The fog makes her insane. So all the things, the typical things about our city are a source of the comic relief in the book.
Well, I tell you, this has been fantastic. You guys are great. I wish we had another hour. I mean, there's so much we could talk about, and maybe we'll do it again down the road.
If you ever want to consult me on any, crime scene or get questions from, I know that this is how we met, right? It was through the crime scene writers group. So I'm on that Yahoo group, and people will occasionally post questions
exactly
about how they can kill somebody off and get away with it. And it's only for literary purposes, not for actual planning purposes.
Exactly.
But I'm always open to discussing possibilities and literary genres. I'm always open to that. So that's great.
And the best way to stay abreast of how we're doing with First Cut and also learn more about Working Stiff is probably through our Facebook page, Dr. Working Stiff.
Right.
And we also post stuff at the website, which is drworkingstiff.com.
Yeah, our listeners know that on our websites we will have links to all of this. We'll have links to Working Stiff and your Facebook, both of your Facebook sites, Twitter, the Pathology Expert site, and some other things, some lectures and things like that. So we have lots on there. Judy, TJ, it's been fantastic. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, there is one more thing I want to mention. Is I don't know when is this going to air, but on Monday, November 16th, we're giving a lecture and a book event at Azusa Pacific University in Los Angeles. That's posted on our website. And then there's also an event in December at the Bar Association of San Francisco.
That's good. Unfortunately, this is going to air after that.
Okay.
That's okay. Our listeners now know that we record these ahead of time. They're not live.
Well, there's also I should also tell you then. Well, in February, we're going to be at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences meeting in Las Vegas.
Oh, well, Jan's going to be there for sure. I might.
Are you? Okay, great. We should get together.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you, and until next time, Crime and Science Radio is off the air.